Music City, Nashville, Tennessee. Two verses and a chorus shy of a hit song. Here they are. It's Scott and it's Hino.
And the Music Roadshow.
Wow, that was a guitar face.
I know.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the Music Roadshow. We're really glad you're here tuning in with us.
Yes, we are. Thanks for hanging out. We'd love for you to join in the conversation. Log on to facebook.com/themusicrowshow and chat alongside with us.
Yeah, you can do that on Twitter at The Music Row Show. Also, as Scott mentioned, Facebook. And after the show, you can go hit up Instagram at The Music Row Show as well. And you can check out all the crazy pictures we put up. And in case you haven't heard,
they're so crazy.
Crazy, I tell you. You know, Dish subscribers, you guys can watch us on TV because Blue Highways is now on Dish.
That's right. You can watch us four times a week on Channel 73 all over the country and for the first time ever right here in Nashville, which is exciting. We've been on TV for, what, 3 years?
Yeah, right about there.
And nobody knew around here, but finally you can see us here.
Yeah, that's right. So anyway, Scott, introduce our guest here this hour. Who's hanging out with us?
Well, this gentleman has literally walked about every road one could walk as a musician, from a hit recording artist as part of the duo Foster and Lloyd to successful songwriter with cuts on Trisha, Martina, Hootie, and many others, to session player, touring player, producer, to artists as varied as Buck Owens to Ray Davies, Carl Perkins to Cheap Trick. He's founded and performs with one of Nashville's favorite bands, the Long Players, and he can be heard regularly at the Bluebird Cafe and in many, many other Music City haunts. We are very, very pleased and excited to say, Bill Lloyd, we're glad you're here. Welcome to the Music Row Show.
Thank you so much. Great to be here.
All right.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Well, big fan, I got to say, big fan. Earlier in your time in Nashville, you were working over at MTM Publishing, weren't you?
MTM was the first real publishing deal I had. I had like a song by song basis with the castle out in Franklin. The Noyens family had their own little setup out there, and I was trading song publishing for demos.
Wow.
I was like, I got to do, you know, sort of master sounding demos, and I would keep my writers, but you know, give them publishing. So they had publishing on some early things of mine, but then that led to getting a real deal at MTM, Mary Tyler Moore, MTM.
Yeah. What do you think that the time that you spent there, what did that do for your songwriting craft and your?
Well, I'd only been in town a few years. I'd been in bands. I had done the co-writing thing for many years, playing in rock
bands.
Because
of the bands, yeah.
Because of the band, and actually worked with great people. You guys probably know who Kim Ritchie is.
Oh yeah. We've had her on.
Well, Kimmy and I were in a band together called Southern Star, which was really like a hippie granola, you know, very much a harmony and singer-songwriter kind of band, like Crosby, Stills, Nash, Young kind of thing, where we all backed each other up, and there was a fellow named David Surface who's quite a good writer still to this day, and Kim and I were all in that band, and then David and I had another couple other pop rock kind of bands before that. So then when I moved to Nashville, it was I had hit a time in my life where I'd broken up with my girlfriend, and it was just time to get out of my hometown, which was Bowling Green, Kentucky. It was where I grew up, and it was just time to go. And I'd already been to New York and came around with no more money, ran out of money and came home. And then, so Nashville was the next step, and that was 1982.
Wow.
When I moved here. And then, within a couple of years though, things started happening, gotten some involved in some bands and kept writing. And I, when I got a publishing deal, it was, I was still learning a lot.
Yeah.
You know,
I'm going to back you up just a little bit because I read that you wanted to be Ricky Nelson as a kid.
Well, no, that's not really. I'm not really wanted to be Ricky Nelson. The first time I saw, before the Beatles, really hit America, I used to see Ricky Nelson on the TV when I was a kid.
Sure.
And there was always a segment at the end of the program where he would get up and play and sing a song. And James Burton was the guitar player. And Joe Osborne was on bass. So he had a great band. A lot of people. People my age know that, but but a lot of people younger don't know that. But Ricky Nelson was very cool. He was like he was in people's homes every week on a TV show, but he was pretty cool rock and roll. So the first records I ever bought that were not like Disney, you know, were Ricky Nelson records. So.
But that got you wanting to write as early as 12, 13, 14. Yeah. I'm just curious, what do you remember about the subject matter early on in your writing?
Very
days?
Derivative of the Beatles, you know, it was all...
I want to hold your wrist.
Well, yeah. I was going to go farther than that, but I'm not even going to go there. It was all... very derivative of the Beatles because they were a self-contained band that wrote their own songs.
Right.
And that was really inspiring. I didn't know about Buddy Holly before that, unless you just played a Buddy Holly bumper.
We did, just a few minutes ago.
But, you know, that was my first exposure to a bunch of guys who hung out together and wrote songs, you know. And so I thought that was fascinating. And back when I was a kid, one more thing, it was... Also, do you remember the Disney thing, 101 Dalmatians?
Yeah, absolutely.
Do you remember in the original, the owner of the dogs was a songwriter?
He's a songwriter.
Right, I do remember that.
What a great job that is.
Sitting there on his piano while Poco would be sitting there. Pongo.
Exactly. Pongo and Perdita.
Yes.
Yeah, and so, that was the first time I ever saw songwriting as being like a job, you know?
Wow.
Was a little kid watching Disney, But it was. I was really inspired by all that whole explosion of music in the '60s. I was the right age.
Wow! Well, I definitely hear the Beatles' influence in some of your music.
Yes, all of it.
Title notwithstanding, your current single "Yesterday."
Yes,
love that song.
Thank you.
Forget about the title.
We tried not to.
As a writer, how do you walk the line of paying tribute to a style and not copying too closely?
You squeeze the sponge and just hope you don't run into a lawyer somewhere along the way. You know?
Okay.
That's kind of the way I look at it, is that you take in all this information, you know, the records you love, the records you don't love, you know. Mm-hmm. You take it all in, and then when you squeeze the sponge, it comes out filtered through you. So
it comes out a little different.
Yeah. It comes out a little different, and people, I don't think they should worry too much about that. I think they should just let it happen, you know, because... something happens when it comes out every individual person, or there's a certain individualness that comes out of the song.
Yeah.
That where even if you think you're sounding like somebody else, you may not be as much as you think. You know?
Yeah, that's interesting.
And also another thing is that you don't always think you're writing third person songs, but you wait a couple of years down the road and then you realize you were writing about yourself.
Oh.
You know, there's a lot of that going on too. So I think songwriting, even if you don't make a penny at it, is great therapy.
That's true.
You know, it's very good for the mental health of whoever gets involved in songwriting. So a lot cheaper than therapy.
Cheaper than therapy. Yeah. What did John Lennon tell L. Russell Brown?
He hated him.
No. What he said? He said, "We're professionals. We don't borrow. We steal."
Yeah.
And he sounded just like that.
Yeah.
My John Lennon sounds a little Irish, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. I wasn't going to say.
That's all right. They can't all be winners, you know.
Yeah.
Oh, well. So you get to town. You're getting your first initial deals. Talk about Nashville in 83, 84. What was the climate like?
I kind of came to town. The stuff I loved in country was sort of vintage country, you know, Hank Williams and George Jones and Buck Owens and things like that. And the younger country stuff that I was buying, the stuff that was in Nashville was Emmylou and Rodney and Roseanne.
Oh, wow.
And stuff like that. And a few other things. There was... right after I got here, Vince Gill got here about the same time, and his early records on RCA I thought were fantastic.
Oh, yeah.
But, you know, I was listening also to Joe Ely and Carlin Carter, Nick Lowe, Dave Edmunds, NRBQ, things like that, which I thought, well, there's a lot of country in that. But when I got here, it was not that. It was very much a pristine kind of showbiz sort of version of country. And I, no offense to any of these people because they're all very talented, but what was on the charts at that time was very pop-oriented stuff.
Right.
You know, very... high gloss, without naming any names, really high gloss pop kind of stuff that was very well made, but it just wasn't speaking to me. And I gravitated more towards the rock side of town and played in clubs along with the other bands that were here at the time, the Scorchers and Webb Wilder and all those. And so I was doing my own pop rock kind of thing. And when I got to MTM Music, Radney Foster had just been signed at the same time. Beth Nielsen Chapman had been signed at the same time. Those are two people that I still write songs with to this day, which is cool. And but Radney and I found the songs that we were writing together were getting some attention. We'd had a cut by a group called Sweethearts of the Rodeo, and then had another, Ricky Van Shelton had cut Crazy of You, which is our first single, but it never was a single for him. And so when we finally went in and got a deal for our own stuff, we made a record of Crazy Over You, and that was like a big hit for us. It was like just sort of ushered us in, and we never quite followed it up with anything that was quite as successful, but we had a bunch of other top five records after that. Sure Thing, What Do You Want From Me This Time, Fair Shake, things like that. So
just the fact that you guys were writing together all the time, I'm assuming you were performing out.
We weren't performing until the record company came calling.
How did that transition happen? You go from songwriters to, hey, let's give these guys a record deal.
Yeah, well, you know what? It was a trend at the time. Steve Earle had gotten a deal out of Silver Line, Gold Line, where he was writing and doing his own thing. The O'Kanes, Kieran Kane and Jamie O'Hara, had gotten a deal with CBS, doing very much the same thing. It was very organic. Steve always called it the great credibility scare at the time. That was his quote about it. But it was a time when, some of the stuff that was happening in mainstream Nashville wasn't selling big, big numbers. Right. Some of it was doing really well. But Alabama was doing very well.
Right.
There were a lot of acts that just were kind of hitting the glass ceiling, and they were looking for something new. They were looking for something more youth oriented. And at that time I was young.
Yeah.
And so I fit that demographic.
Yeah.
And we had kind of a rock edge to what we were doing, a little different than what the O'Kanes were doing, or slightly more Beatles-esque than what Dwight Yoakam was doing. Everybody kind of fit in their own little niche during that period. And so, we ended up throwing a band together. We'd already had a cassette tape full of demos, and they said, "Well, just if this is black and white, make that color." You know, it's like the Wizard of Oz. You know, when you go open up the door and everything's going, you go. A guy named Joe Galani, who ran RCA, said,
"Yeah,
he said, if these demos are black and white, just consider going to the studio and making them color." So that's what we did, and we got very lucky.
So what goes on in your head? Because like you said, you're a rocker. You came here and you kind of...
I do love country music.
Sure you do.
And they have a real knowledge of it.
But like you said, you were on the rock side of town.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, you got a writing deal, and then poof, you're a country music star, artist.
Well, it never really became too much stardom for us. We had some hit records, but it didn't really feel like... no tour buses were going by our houses or anything like that.
Right.
But it was a time when we had a lot of attention at that time, and that everybody from that era was getting a lot of nice write ups in all the newspapers, and the especially the music press was really kind to all the people I just mentioned a minute ago, Steve Earles and the Dwight Yoakams and stuff. Everybody was writing about that era, and we were lucky to get in with that period of time. When that attention was being focused,
right.
So, but we were never stars.
Well,
you know.
Let me rephrase the question then, because I just think it's interesting that, you know, how all of a sudden you're in a limelight that it's like, were you ever thinking, how on earth did all this happen?
A little bit. It felt like it was done with mirrors or something. You know, I remember first number one party was. How in the world does that happen? How does it go all the way to number one? And you don't want to know.
You're just happy that it did. Yeah.
Yeah. But anyway, it was just fun. It was really a good time. And we were allowed to make three albums during that period.
Wow.
Actually diminishing returns is the longer we went.
Sure.
With country radio, they were not... our second album was called Faster and Louder, So that was a tip off right there. Right. But we did have you know, some support from the label, and they were great. And but we felt the tide turning.
Yeah.
You know, and so Radney wanted to go do his own thing, and I got into a band situation with John Cowan from Newgrass and Pat Simmons from the Doobies and Rusty Young from Poco.
Now this isn't
The Sky Kings.
Oh, the Sky Kings.
Yeah.
Let's take a break, and we'll talk about that. We're here.
Well, we should mention that our sponsor for this segment is Toyota of Cool Springs.
Tell us about it, Hino.
Well, you know, as everybody probably knows by now, we mention it all the time. Scott and I are both Toyota drivers, and mm-hmm. We just love that dealership. When we have to go get our car worked on or serviced or anything, or even if we're in the market for a car, it's just such a comfortable place to go. They provide a great experience for people. There's no pressure. You don't feel in any way badgered.
It. Even if you're looking around at cars, nobody's jumping on you. Right. You know, it's a cool place to go. They got good coffee.
And if my wife has to take the car in for any reason, I feel comfortable knowing that, you know, they're going to steer her right. And, you know, you hear stories about other, you know, auto shops, you know, mm-hmm. when they see somebody coming, you know, so.
Absolutely. Go see George. He's the owner there. ToyotaofCoolSprings.com. They're good people, and we love going to them. I think producer Logan's going to be hitting there this week. So
sweet.
Check him out. We're going to be back with more of Bill Lloyd right here on the Music Row Show.
Welcome back to the Music Row Show. That's Bill Lloyd, our guest, doing Yesterday. You could totally hear the Beatle influence in that. I love that song.
Well, thank you. I wrote that with Tom Peterson from the rock band Cheap Trick.
Yeah.
And that's him playing bass on it.
Nice.
And then through the magic of overdubbing, I'm playing everything else. So
wow.
So it's just it was going to be a one-man band thing, but when he offered to put his bass on, I thought, well, I might as well give him a break.
Might as well have him on there.
Might as well give him a break. I'm glad he adds so much to everything he does. We get to work together.
He might actually make it someday if he keeps
working.
Yeah,
they just got in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
Yeah, isn't that awesome?
I'm so happy for him.
I love that band.
I have one more Foster and Lloyd question. How did you compartmentalize the country gig and the power pop projects like Feeling the Elephant?
Feeling the Elephant came out before Foster.
Was it before?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I just didn't know if the label had issues with you playing.
Well,
now
you know what? They knew it was coming. In fact, when I did a party at the Exit Inn for Feeling the Elephant when it came out, that was 1986. Radney and I had already signed our deal with RCA. So I had a guy named Chuck Warner, who was the president of Throbbing Lobster Records out of Boston.
Wow.
And he was down from Boston. And so there's this funny group picture of like Nashville, you know, Joe Galani and me, and then Chuck, who was Mr. Throbbing Lobster, president for life, he used to have on his card. I used to love that. His business card said president for life. RCA, instead of making it a bad thing, they tried, it may have gotten into the way eventually, but you know, in terms of just image it actually helped us get, I think, some press to start off with. I mean, no other bands on RCA in Nashville at that time got reviewed in Rolling Stone.
Yeah.
But we did. So, and I think that kind of thing may have helped it. Maybe.
Very cool.
Maybe.
Wow.
You know, so.
I'll take that answer. Okay.
So there was a certain amount of compartmentalizing, but not, you just write a song, you know, you can figure out where it's supposed to go after you get done with it.
Well, so, we've got you all geared up with a guitar here. You feel like playing something for us?
I have a guitar in my lap. Yeah.
I'll
do a song that I wrote with Beth Nielsen Chapman, who I love to write songs with. I have for many, many years. And this is a song that was cut by Beth on one of her records very good, well, but also we had a European hit with this with a girl named Ilse DeLange. And it was actually quite a big hit over there. So it's called World of Hurt.
Okay.
So it goes like this. Well, day one, God smiled and gave us all the wisdom of a newborn child. By the time we take our first step, we've already begun to forget what the heart knows and the heart sees. We're just as much the forest as we are the trees. Every single seed trying to find where that light comes from. It's just a world of hurt when nothing works. It's a lonely little planet made of dust and dirt. Who'd ever think in the midst of all this, something as beautiful as love exists? So when I hold you and you hold me, heaven doesn't seem like such a mystery. In a world of hurt, you make me feel so good. Now day one of our love, two heartbroken people scared to trust too much. But here comes that feeling again, the one that every lover swears will never end. You say we've been there, done that, but when we kissed, we'd never been here. We never done this. All the walls come tumbling down when you love someone. It's just a world of hurt when nothing works. It's a lonely little planet made of dust and dirt. Who'd ever think that in the midst of all this, something as beautiful as love exists? So when I hold you and you hold me, heaven doesn't seem like such a mystery. In a world of hurt, you make me feel so good. Feel so good.
Yeah.
So nice.
Thank you.
You know what? I have that album, and I love that song.
Thank you.
Yeah, that's.
Had the title sitting around for a long time.
Yeah.
And tried it out on a couple other writers, and didn't get anywhere. And Beth heard it, and she goes, yeah, "I like that."
Such a great groove. Yeah.
We have written quite a few songs over the years.
Okay, you just said something that struck me there. You said you tried it with a couple other writers.
I tried the title. I tried to see if the title would go somewhere.
Okay, but yeah, you didn't actually start working on it.
No.
Has that ever happened where you're working on a song with somebody and you just feel like, man, this is going nowhere with the bullet with this person?
Yeah, I've done it. Yeah, that's happened.
How do you?
Brittany Foster.
You say you just pull it back and you say, you know, I think I want to do, just be honest, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, it may be a little socially awkward, maybe, especially if you don't know the person very well.
Right.
But I think it's best to be honest and just say, you know, I don't think I can do anything with this, you know? And the idea, mm-hmm, once you have a song, is that, you know, you want to go out and play it for people.
Sure.
Or you want to record it, or, yeah, you know, and that's the whole idea of it. So, I mean, if one of the writers is saying, nah, you just best to, you know, go have lunch, you know, or figure out something else to do for a minute and then start again. I've done that. And then sometimes you'll come back and write something completely different, and that'll be the winner, you know?
Right.
But, I think it's, yeah, but that is one of those songs that had it as a title. I had the title sitting around for a while.
Hmm.
So
that's interesting.
You know. Yeah. So, but you've done a lot of producing over the years.
I did, yeah. I haven't in a couple years, but I produced, the last thing I produced was a rock band out of Bowling Green called The Secret. And
can you tell us about them?
Well, they're really just brilliant, great band. Great band. But back in the early 90s, I had my own home studio, and I also, through the good graces of being on RCA Records, I was doing, you know, Foster and Lloyd were self-produced. That's another thing. We were allowed to produce ourselves, which was very rare. Maybe still, you know, it also allowed me to get in the studio with people like Carl Perkins.
Wow.
Which was real exciting.
Yeah.
And there were a handful of things. Sweethearts of the Rodeo. Kim Ritchie, I mentioned Kim earlier. Yeah. The early demos that she did that helped get her publishing deal, we worked together on all those on.
Yeah.
So.
How did being a producer, how did that differ creatively from songwriting for you? And how did they complement each other?
You've got an overview rather than being in the middle of it all. Because if you don't have that sort of like, we got to have my line in there that I came up with about whatever, you know. Yeah. You know, your ego's not tied into it like that. You're looking at it from a point of view of, as much from trying to please the record label, because you know that the record label's gonna,
right,
be the ones putting the money into it to make. So you want them happy. You want the artist happy. It's like almost like a little political headspace you have to kind of get into of trying to please everybody, but making sure that in the long run, the project itself has some real merit, and that the artist can always walk away proud.
Yeah.
Because their name's on it, their face is on the cover.
Well, you mentioned earlier that a lot of the stuff that was going on earlier, and, you know, some would argue even now, that it had a certain gloss to it.
Yeah.
And a lot of production. Did you ever have any pressure to do that as a producer?
I didn't know how to do that.
Okay. Well, that helps.
That just means spend more money as far as I was concerned. That would mean bringing in extra players to play like that. And I would always get to pick players and play with guys that were, that I liked or whatever.
There's something great about the sound of just, you know, four or five instruments, you know, bass, drum, guitar, keyboard. And that's it.
Yeah.
I mean, that there's something cool about that.
Yeah. There was very few keyboards on Foster and Lloyd Records. I threw some piano on there occasionally, but it was mostly all steel guitar. Sometimes Sam Bush would come and play some fiddle.
Oh, yeah.
Or we had Jerry Douglas play dobro, or had some guest guitar players like Marshall Crenshaw, Vince Gill, Bernie Ledden from the Eagles.
Wow.
We had some cool guests, but overall we kept it bass, drums, guitar.
Yeah.
I love and vocals. That
real basic. Well, I'm curious, having grown up loving the pop bands of the 60s and 70s, you were a fan of the Beatles and the Who and the Kinks. Okay, so you're accomplished, you're successful, but with all of that, how do you still keep from geeking out when you're working with a Ray Davies?
Well, just try not to, you know. We went to pick up food for, he was recording with Ray Kennedy. And I got to be on that project really just because he wanted me on it. Ray had hired another friend of mine to play guitar, the great Pat Buchanan, who's a fabulous guitar player, plays with me a lot too. And Pat was the guy for the gig, but Ray nicely wanted me on there because we'd gotten sort of friendly through Tommy Womack and I cutting one of his songs for a tribute. And I got to meet him with Tommy, and then I went up and auditioned as a guitar player for him in New York, so I got to know him further than that. And then so he just said, well, I'd love to have Bill on the session. So I went out to Ray's, and that was just unreal for me. Because to me, you know, for that full circle meeting your heroes kind of thing,
right?
You know, Ray's right up there with the Beatles and the Beach Boys or Brian Wilson or, you know, and any of those guys who just really meant the world to me as a kid, you know. And there's a certain geek factor there, but of meeting your heroes.
Yeah,
but
just kind of keep it all down, like, what's up, Ray?
You talk about real life stuff, you know.
Yeah.
You just keep it human.
Yeah.
All right. You know? Well, awesome. Well, listen, we're going to take a quick break, but we definitely want to let you know that Our sponsor of this segment is Dogwood Cabins.
Oh, let me tell you about this place. So you and I, we love going to Gatlinburg.
Yeah, love it.
We take our families. The wives love going out there. The music, the moonshine, people watching. But let me tell you about Townsend, Tennessee. It's kind of the peaceful side of the Smokies. If you want to get away from the rush, the tourists, and just enjoy the quiet beauty of the Smoky Mountains, go to dogwoodcabins.com, book your cabin. I know you're going to go out there in the next couple of weeks, right?
Absolutely, yeah.
You're going to take your wife, mm-hmm. little fire, little blanket, little sleep. Comfy couch, and
and
go
sleep.
To sleep, yeah. But listen, beautiful cabins, amazing views, and no crowds. I love Gatlinburg, but it's really nice to go where there's no crowds in the Smoky Mountains. Mm-hmm. Dogwoodcabins.com, that's dogwoodcabins.com. We're going to be right back with more of the great Bill Lloyd right here on the Music Row Show. Stick around.
Laughing at the edges of the life I live.
Welcome back to the Music Row Show.
All those men.
You might remember that song. That's Crazy If You Let It. Andrea Zahn was on our show just a couple months ago.
That's a great...
And that was co-written by our guest here this hour, Bill Lloyd.
And you did a few songs with her on that album, didn't you?
I got so lucky. I got in the loop of writing with her.
Yeah.
When she was putting together songs for this record. I'd already written some songs with Tom Utes, who she was already working
right.
with.
Uh-huh.
So I'd already written a couple songs with him, and... Andre and I have been talking about writing songs together for years, and I just happened to get in the loop, and we wrote some. But it was kind of a magical little thing of she and Tom and I have three on there together, and then there's another one with just the two of me and Andrea, and then but Tom's got a bunch more. He's all over that record.
Well, let me tell you, so, that is one of those albums that literally I've stopped the car and just listened to the entire album, turned off the phone, and listened from start to finish. Mm-hmm. It's beautiful, and you did some great stuff on that.
Thank
Congrats.
You. Just happy to be a part of it, really. That's, mm-hmm. She's the one who brought in all these fantastic players.
Man.
And,
yeah.
And singers. You know, that was Vince Gill singing harmony with her on that one. And but Keb Moe's on another one, and James Taylor and Trace Atkins, all these great people.
All those hacks.
And all those hacks.
Yeah. So, hey, how about one more song from you?
Okay, well, being New Year's, you know, mm-hmm. a lot of looking back at what the last year was like. This is a sort of a sad song because I lost a good friend this year. So this is goes out to dear departed friend. What you're having from the night before the morning after, 'cause that's how it was, at least what I remember. A midnight kitchen full of laughter, taken away, ready or not. And never took the time to say. All I forgot or thought that I knew, the one thing I know that's true, the world's a different place without you. Horizon, 'cause I've got a joke and a couple of questions if eternity is worth surviving. So send me a dream while I'm asleep and show me all I'm not supposed to know.
trust me to keep a secret or two. Just leave out what I already knew. The world's a different place without you.
So pretty. So pretty. Well, okay, we're going to take another quick break.
That's a good idea.
We're going to be back with more of Bill Lloyd. You're listening to The Music Row Show. We'll be right back.
I don't ever look back. I just want to feel this moment. Follow where it's going, baby. I don't ever look back. That's just dancing with the past.
Oh yeah, welcome back to the Music Row Show. That's a tune called Dancing with the Past. Written by our guest here this hour, Bill Lloyd. And actually, I got a songwriting question for you. First line of a song is so important. And I noticed Boy King of Tokyo. I love that song.
Thank you.
And the first line of that song is probably, in my book, one of the greatest first lines ever.
Thank you.
I was a big surprise to the bride and groom when I set up shop in my mother's womb. And I was like, yeah. So how do you go about crafting a grabby first line?
I don't know. It kind of comes to you. You know, your antenna's up, and hopefully you're there to receive it when it happens. One of my favorite, going back to the Foster and Lloyd thing, Dancing with the Past, back to Foster and Lloyd.
Yeah.
I remember we had a song on our third album called Side of the Road. And its opening line was, Gary grew up in Gary, Indiana, home of both his parents and the Jackson Five. And that was one of my favorite first lines that we ever had.
That's awesome.
Yeah. Well, craft-wise, how do you think you've evolved as a writer over the years? Is that anything you've ever put any thought to?
I haven't really thought about it much. I want to think that I'm better now than I ever was, you know? Mm-hmm. I'm probably kidding myself, though, you know? I don't know. I tend to write, I wrote a whole lot of songs when I wrote for several different publishing companies. And, you know, and very often when you're co-writing, you end up writing a whole lot of stuff and even things get demoed that your heart may not have been into 100%.
Right.
And I would just, that would be advice right there. Don't do that. I spent a lot of years kind of going with the flow, thinking, okay, well, this person, they had success here, so maybe they know something I don't know. I think follow your own instincts all the way, and don't, you know. Do you know who Robbie Foulkes is?
No.
Robbie's a Chicago guy who makes great records, and he's a great, brilliant songwriter. And he has a song about Nashville, and he says, I can't remember the first line, but the second line was, I ate a lot of lunch and I wrote a lot of dumbass songs. and it was just about his time being in Nashville. And I understand what he means by that, because I think there's a tendency, especially when you're writing by committee.
Yeah.
And you're writing for committee at a record label, you know, that the purity of having a singular idea and going with it gets lost. And so I think, if I could give any sort of advice to anybody, I would say don't lose that. You know, keep that singular idea of a pure idea of a song. And maybe you should write it on your own and not write it in a committee.
Right.
You know, because, you know, and maybe that song will be I heard you play Gentle on My Mind earlier, mm-hmm. John Hartford. You know, maybe that will be that or some song that breaks down walls, breaks down barriers, you know.
Yeah.
No, go ahead.
Well, I'm just curious. I understand what writing by committee is like.
Yeah.
What would you say writing for a committee, you know, what happens? Let's say you don't have to name names or anything, but let's say you've written a song. How does the committee come in and what do they do?
Their jobs. It's part of their job, and their job is to make sure that they still have a job at the end of the day.
So what do they ask for? Line rewrites?
They can work at the publishing house. They can work at the manager's office.
Right.
They can work for the record label. They can be an assistant to the artist. They can be anybody mm-hmm. that is in the chain of command that stands between that song and the artist cutting the song. And so if you're not the artist yourself, that is the game you play, I think. And so anybody who's in one of those positions of gatekeeping, you know, can swerve the, you know, make the song go a different direction.
Interesting.
Wow. Don't you think? I mean, I've seen it happen before. So I sort of feel like, the artists who cut the very best possible version of their song and can do it themselves, you know, and where it stands alone, to where even if it goes through a rewrite somewhere else, you still got that, you know.
Yeah.
That's a good thing.
Wow. Well, excuse me. Let's talk about what you've been doing. You've had some Bluebird rounds that have benefited the First Amendment Center. Talk about the organization and Freedom Sings.
I met a guy named Ken Paulson, who is now the dean at MTSU. Mm-hmm. Ken was the executive director at the First Amendment Center, working with John Siegenthaler. I don't know if you know who John Siegenthaler was. John was the he was sort of made famous. There's a bridge named after him downtown. He was the editor of the Tennessean for many years, and he was a civil rights activist. And actually, Bobby Kennedy sent him into Selma, Alabama, and he got hit over the head with a pipe. But he was one of the good guys, and also a tireless free speech enthusiast. And they started this thing through USA Today and Mr. Siegenthaler, called the First Amendment Center, and Ken got me involved in that. We got to be friends, and for the last almost, it'll be 18 years coming up this coming year, I've been sort of their musical director, and a lot of people kind of come in and out of that. And we do shows really from coast to coast all over the place for the last 17 years.
Ever-changing lineup of great
players. Of great players and great musicians. A lot of people have been in and out of it. I mean, there's the yearly thing at the Bluebird is fantastic, but there's a road show that features just recently. It's been Des Dickerson from Prince's band. You remember Little Red Corvette?
You know?
And let me see who else. Seth Timms, Joseph Wooten from the Wooten Brothers, Ashley Cleveland, Susie Ragsdale, who's Ray Stevens' daughter. Beautiful girl, and a great songwriter, and just any number of people have been through the thing.
That's great. Awesome. So if people want to find out about it, where can they go?
Look up Freedom Sings. Just you could Google Freedom Sings and you'll find some information about it. So that's something I've been doing. And I also host programs at the Country Music Hall of Fame for a show called Nashville Cats.
Right.
Yeah. Got one coming up January 23rd with Duane Eddy.
Nice.
So that I'm looking forward to that.
Nashville, January 23rd, can you go online and get tickets?
You can just go down to the Country Music Hall of Fame. And if you don't have the best deal is to get one of those passes, yearly pass, because you can go see all the programs for that way rather than just buy a single ticket. But if you just buy it, it's free with the single ticket admission.
Okay, great. You know?
And it's a program I've been doing now for 10 years which moves the spotlight over from the singer to the players the sidemen and the session guys who write some of the licks that stay in your head, you know?
Duane Eddy, that'll be a great one.
I'm looking forward to that very much. That's January 23rd.
Sweet.
That's great. Well, this has been a real pleasure. Thank you so much for coming in. We've enjoyed it.
Thanks for letting me play some songs, too.
Yeah, man. Yeah. Happy New Year to you.
Happy New Year.
Speaking of songs, we still got a minute left. You had a project called Reset, which I thought was really cool.
I had gone back and found some original demos and some live tracks and then re-recorded some songs from an album I had called Set to Pop. And so I called it Reset, hitting the reset button. And it's the same set of songs, but
done in a new way.
They're alternate versions, you know. So that was like a testament to having lived that long.
Yeah, I thought that was such a great idea because it was a radically different version of the songs that you heard previously.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
And it was just a really real cool thing. I really enjoyed that. So
thank you.
I was just curious how you came up with that idea.
I don't know. It struck me after 20 years. I hit that 20th anniversary of that album, and I went, holy cow, it's been 20 years.
Yeah.
So, you know, and then I realized I had about most of the record already done just in terms of alternate versions on demos or, or live versions or things. So I just went in and cut a few new things. And
well, if people want to buy your music, where can they go?
They need to go to Bill Lloyd Music. It's all four L's in a row. B-I-L-L-L-O-I-D music.net.
All right. BillLloydMusic.net. Do that. Do yourself a favor and go get some of that music because it's good, good stuff.
Thank you
four
so much.
L's.
Four L's in a
four
row.
Four L's.
Yeah. And then after you're done doing that, go to themusicrowshow.com and check us out and listen to some podcasts. Send us a note. We'd love to hear from you. We'll see you next week on The Music Row Show.
Thanks, gentlemen.